The albino's heavy footsteps thudded away down the corridor. Glockter lay still for a moment, then cautiously moved his right arm, ever so slowly, breath rasping with the effort, and tried to twist himself onto his back. He clenched his fist as the needling started in his left leg. If only the damn thing would stay numb. But the pain was coming on fast now. He was also becoming aware of an unpleasant smell. Damn it, I've shit myself again.
Barnum!
Howled Glockter, then waited, panting, left side throbbing with a vengeance. Where is the old idiot?
Barnum!
He screamed at the top of his lungs.
Are you all right, sir?
Came the servant's voice from beyond the door.
All right, you old fool. Just when do you think I was last all right?
No, damn it! I've soiled the bed! I've boiled water for a bath, sir. Can you get up?
Once before, Frost had had to break the door down. Maybe I should let it stand open all night. But then how could I sleep?
I think I can manage,
Glockter hissed, tongue pressed into his empty gums, arms trembling as he hauled himself out of the bed and onto the chair beside it. His grotesque, toeless left leg twitched to itself, still beyond his control. He glared down at it with a burning hatred.
Fucking horrible thing. Revolting, useless lump of flesh. Why didn't they just cut you off? Why don't I still?
But he knew why not. With his legs still on, he could at least pretend to be half a man. He punched his withered thigh, then immediately regretted it.
Stupid, stupid.
The pain crept up his back, a little more intense than before, and growing with every second.
Come now, let's not fight.
He started to rub gently at the wasted flesh.
We are stuck with each other, so why torment me?
Can you get to the door, sir?
Glockter wrinkled his nose at the smell, then took hold of his cane, and slowly, agonizingly, pushed himself to his feet. He hobbled across the room, almost slipping halfway there, but righting himself with a searing twinge. He turned the key in the lock, leaning against the wall for balance, and hauled the door open. Barnum was standing on the other side, his arms outstretched, ready to catch him.
The ignominy of it. To think that I, Sandan Glockter, the greatest swordsman the Union has ever seen, must be carried to my bath by an old man so that I can wash my own shit off. They must be laughing loud now, all those fools I beat, if they still remember me. I'd be laughing, too, if it didn't hurt so much.
But he leapt the weight off his left leg and put his arm round Barnum's shoulders without complaint.
What's the use, after all? Might as well make it easy for myself. As easy as it can be.
Glockter took a deep breath.
Go gently. The leg hasn't woken up yet.
They hopped and stumbled down the corridor, slightly too narrow for both of them together. The bathroom seemed a mile away.
Or more. I'd rather walk 100 miles as I used to be than to the bathroom as I am. But that's my bad luck, isn't it? You can't go back. Not ever.
The steam felt deliciously warm on Glockter's clammy skin. With Barnum holding him under the arms, he slowly lifted his right leg and put it gingerly into the water.
Damn it, that's hot.
The old servant helped him get the other leg in, then, taking him under the armpits, lowered him like a child until he was immersed up to his neck.
Ah!
Glockter cracked a toothless smile.
Hot as the Maker's forge, Barnum. Just the way I like it.
The heat was getting into the leg now, and the pain was subsiding. Not gone.
Never gone. But better. A lot better.
Glockter began to feel almost as if he could face another day.
You have to learn to love the small things in life, like a hot bath, You have to love the small things when you've nothing else.
Practical Frost was waiting for him downstairs in the tiny dining room, his bulk wedged into a low chair against the wall. Glockter sagged into the other chair and caught a whiff from the steaming porridge bowl, wooden spoon sticking up at an angle without even touching the side. His stomach rumbled and his mouth began watering fiercely. All the symptoms, in fact, of extreme nausea.
"Hooray!" shouted Glockter. "Porridge again!"
He looked over at the motionless practical.
"Porridge and honey, better than money. Everything's funny with porridge and honey."
The pink eyes did not blink.
"It's a rhyme for children. My mother used to sing it to me. Never actually got me to eat this slop, though. But now," and he dug the spoon in, "I can't get enough of it."
Frost stared back at him.
"Healthy," said Glockter, forcing down a mouthful of sweet mush and spooning up another. "Delicious."
Choking down some more.
"And here's the real clincher."
He gagged slightly on the next swallow.
"No chewing required."
He shoved the mostly full bowl away and tossed the spoon after it.
"Hmm," he hummed. "A good breakfast makes for a good day, don't you find?"
It was like staring at a whitewashed wall, but without all the emotion.
"So, the Archlector wants me again, does he?"
The albino nodded.
"And what might our illustrious leader desire with the likes of us, do you think?"
A shrug.
"Hmm."
Glockter licked bits of porridge out of his empty gums.
"Does he seem in a good mood, do you know?"
Another shrug.
"Come, come, Practical Frost, don't tell me everything at once, I can't take it in."
Silence. Barnum entered the room and cleared away the bowl.
"Do you want anything else, sir?"
"Absolutely. A big half-raw slab of meat and a nice crunchy apple."
He looked over at Practical Frost.
"I used to love apples when I was a child."
How many times have I made that joke? Frost looked back impassively. There was no laughter there. Glockter turned to Barnum, and the old man gave a tired smile.
"Oh, well," sighed Glockter. "A man has to have hope, doesn't he?"
"Of course, sir,"
muttered the servant, heading for the door.
"Does he?"
The Archlector's office was on the top floor of the House of Questions, and it was a long way up. Worse still, the corridors were busy with people. Practicals, clerks, inquisitors, crawling like ants through a crumbling dunghill. Whenever he felt their eyes on him, Glockter would limp along, smiling, head held high. Whenever he felt himself alone, he would pause and gasp, sweat and curse, and rub and slap the tenuous life back into his leg.
"Why does it have to be so high?"
he asked himself as he shuffled up the dim halls and winding stairs of the labyrinthine building. By the time he reached the antechamber, he was exhausted and blowing hard, left hand sore on the handle of his cane. The Archlector's secretary examined him suspiciously from behind a big dark desk that took up half the room. There were some chairs placed opposite for people to get nervous waiting in, and two huge practicals flanked the great double doors to the office, so still and grim as to appear a part of the furniture.
"Do you have an appointment?"
demanded the secretary in a shrill voice.
"You know who I am, you self-important little shit."
"Of course," snapped Glockter. "Do you think I limped all the way up here to admire your desk?"
The secretary looked down his nose at him. He was a pale, handsome young man with a mop of yellow hair. The puffed-up fifth son of some minor nobleman with overactive loins, and he thinks he can patronize me.
"And your name is?"
he asked with a sneer. Glockter's patience was worn out by the climb. He smashed his cane down on the top of the desk, and the secretary in there jumped out of his chair.
What are you, a fucking idiot? How many crippled inquisitors do you have here?
Said the secretary, mouth working nervously.
Is that a number? Speak up!
Well,
I'm Glockter, you dolt. Inquisitor Glockter.
Yes, sir, I...
Get your fat ass out of that chair, fool. Don't keep me waiting.
The secretary sprang up, hurried to the doors, pushed one open, and stood aside respectfully.
That's better, growled Glockter, shuffling after him.
He looked up at the practicals as he hobbled past. He was almost sure one of them had a slight smile on his face. The room had hardly changed since he was last there 6 years before. It was a cavernous, round space, domed ceiling carved with gargoyle faces, its one enormous window offering a spectacular view over the spires of the university, a great section of the outer wall of the Agriont, and the looming outline of the House of the Maker beyond. The chamber was mostly lined with shelves and cabinets, stacked high with neatly ordered files and papers. A few dark portraits peered down from the sparse white walls, including a huge one of the current King of the Union as a young man, looking wise and stern. No doubt painted before he became a senile joke. These days there's usually a bit less authority and a bit more stray drool about him. There was a heavy round table in the centre of the room, its surface painted with a map of the Union in exquisite detail. Every city in which there was a department of the Inquisition was marked with a precious stone, and a tiny silver replica of Adua rose out of the table at its hub. The Archlector was sitting in an ancient high chair at this table, deep in conversation with another man, a gaunt, balding, sour-faced old fellow in dark robes. Salt beamed up as Glockter shuffled towards them, the other man's expression hardly changed.
"Why, Inquisitor Glockter, delighted you could join us. Do you know Surveyor General Halleck?"
"I have not had the pleasure," said Glockter.
Not that it looks like much of a pleasure, though. The old bureaucrat stood and shook Glockter's hand without enthusiasm.
"And this is one of my inquisitors, Sandan Glockter."
"Yes, indeed," murmured Halleck. "You used to be in the army, I believe. I saw you fence once."
Glockter tapped his leg with his cane.
"That can't have been any time recently."
"No."
There was a silence.
"The Surveyor General is likely soon to receive a more significant promotion," said Salt, "to a chair on the Closed Council itself."
The Closed Council, indeed. A most significant promotion. Halleck seemed less than delighted, however.
"I will consider it done when it is His Majesty's pleasure to invite me," he snapped, "and not before."
Salt floated smoothly over this rocky ground.
"I'm sure the Council feels that you are the only candidate worth recommending, now that Septan Teufel is no longer being considered."
Our old friend Teufel, no longer considered for what? Halleck frowned and shook his head.
"Teufel! I worked with the man for 10 years. I never liked him."
"Or anyone else, by the look of you."
"But I would never have thought him a traitor."
Salt shook his head sadly.
"We all feel it keenly. But here is his confession in black and white."
He held up the folded paper with a doleful frown.
"I fear the roots of corruption can run very deep. Who would know that better than I, whose sorry task it is to weed the garden?"
"Indeed, indeed,"
muttered Halleck, nodding grimly.
"You deserve all of our thanks for that. You also, Inquisitor."
"Oh, no, not I,"
said Glockter humbly. The three men looked at each other in a sham of mutual respect. Halleck pushed back his chair.
"Well, taxes do not collect themselves. I must return to my work."
"Enjoy your last few days in the job," said Salt. "I give you my word that the King will send for you soon."
Halleck allowed himself the thinnest of smiles, then nodded stiffly to them and stalked away. The secretary ushered him out and pulled the heavy door shut. There was silence. But I'm damned if I'll be the one to break it.
I expect you're wondering what this was all about, eh, Glockter?
The thought had crossed my mind, Your Eminence.
I bet it had.
Salt swept from his chair and strode across to the window, his white-gloved hands clasped behind his back.
The world changes, Glockter. The world changes. The old order crumbles. Loyalty, duty, pride, honour. Notions that have fallen far from fashion. What has replaced them?
He glanced over his shoulder for a moment, and his lip curled.
Greed. Merchants have become the new power in the land. Bankers, shopkeepers, salesmen. Little men with little minds and little ambitions. Men whose only loyalty is to themselves, whose only duty is to their own purses, whose only pride is in swindling their betters, whose only honour is weighed out in silver coin.
No need to ask where you stand on the merchant class.
Salt scowled out at the view, then turned back into the room.
Now it seems anyone's son can get an education and a business and become rich. The merchant guilds, the mercers, the spicers and their like grow steadily in wealth and influence. Jumped up posturing commoners, dictating to their natural betters. Their fat and greedy fingers fumbling at the strings of power. It is almost too much to stand.
He gave a shudder as he paced across the floor.
I will speak honestly with you, Inquisitor.
The Archlector waved his graceful hand as though his honesty were a priceless gift.
The Union has never seemed more powerful, has never controlled more land, but beneath the facade we are weak. It is hardly a secret that the King has become entirely unable to make his own decisions. Crown Prince Ladislaus is a fop, surrounded by flatterers and fools, caring for nothing but gambling and clothes. Prince Reynold is far better fitted to rule, but he is the younger brother. The closed council, whose task it should be to steer this leaking vessel, is packed with frauds and schemers. Some may be loyal, some are definitely not, each intent on pulling the king his own way.
How frustrating, when I suppose they should all be pulling him in yours.
Meanwhile, the Union is beset with enemies, dangers outside our borders, and dangers within. Gurkul has a new and vigorous emperor, fitting his country for another war. The Northmen are up in arms as well, skulking on the borders of Angland. In the open council, the noblemen clamour for ancient rights, while in the villages the peasants clamour for new ones.
He gave a deep sigh.
Yes, the old order crumbles, and no one has the heart or the stomach to support it.
Salt paused, staring up at one of the portraits. A hefty, bald man dressed all in white. Glockter recognized him well enough.
Zola, the greatest of all archlectors, tireless champion of the Inquisition, hero to the torturer, scourge of the disloyal.
He glared down balefully from the wall, as though even beyond death he could burn traitors with a glance.
Zola, growled Salt. Things were different in his day, I can tell you. No whinging peasants then, no swindling merchants, no sulking noblemen. If men forgot their place, they were reminded with hot iron, and any carping judge who dared to whine about it was never heard from again. The Inquisition was a noble institution, filled with the best and the brightest. To serve their king and to root out disloyalty were their only desires and their only rewards.
Oh, things were grand in the old days.
The Archlector slid back into his seat and leaned forward across the table.
Now we have become a place where third sons of impoverished noblemen can line their pockets with bribes, or where near-criminal scum can indulge a passion for torture. Our influence with the king has been steadily eroded. Our budgets have been steadily cut. Once we were feared and respected, Glockter, but now...
we're a miserable sham.
Salt frowned.
Well, less so. Intrigues and treasons abound, and I fear that the Inquisition is no longer equal to its task. Too many of the superiors can no longer be trusted. They are no longer concerned with the interests of the king, or of the state, or of anybody's interests beyond their own.
The superiors? Not to be trusted? I swoon with the shock.
Salt's frown grew still deeper.
And now Feecht is dead.
Glockter looked up. Now that is news.
The Lord Chancellor?
It will become public knowledge tomorrow morning. He died suddenly a few nights ago, while you were busy with your friend Ruse. There are still some questions surrounding his death, but the man was nearly 90. The surprise is that he lasted this long. The Golden Chancellor, they called him, the greatest politician of his day. Even now they are setting his likeness in stone for a statue on the Kingsway.
Salt snorted to himself.
The greatest gift that any of us can hope for.
The Archlector's eyes narrowed to blue slits.
If you have any childish notions that the Union is controlled by its king, or by those prating blue-blood fools on the Open Council, you can let them wilt now. The closed council is where the power lies, more than ever since the king's illness. 12 men in 12 big, uncomfortable chairs, myself among them. 12 men with very different ideas, and for 20 years, war and peace, Feecht held us in balance. He played off the Inquisition against the judges, the bankers against the military. He was the axle on which the kingdom turned, the foundation on which it rested, and his death has left a hole. All kinds of gaping holes. And people will be rushing to fill them. I have a feeling that whining-ass Moravia, that bleeding heart of a high justice, that self-appointed champion of the common man will be first in the queue. It is a fluid and a dangerous situation.
The Archlector planted his fists firmly on the table before him.
We must ensure that the wrong people do not take advantage of it.
Glockter nodded. I think I take your meaning, Archlector. We must ensure that it is we who take advantage and no one else.
It need hardly be said that the post of Lord Chancellor is one of the most powerful in the realm. The gathering of taxes, the treasury, the king's mints, all come under his auspices. Money, Glockter, money. And money is power, I need hardly tell you. A new Chancellor will be appointed tomorrow. The foremost candidate was our erstwhile master of the mints, Septan Teufel.
I see. Something tells me he will no longer be under consideration.
Salt's lip curled.
Teufel was closely linked with the merchant guilds, and the mercers in particular.
His sneer became a scowl.
In addition to which, he was an associate of High Justice Moravia. So you see, he would hardly have made a suitable Lord Chancellor.
No, indeed, hardly suitable.
Surveyor General Halleck is a far better choice, in my opinion.
Glockter looked towards the door.
Him? Lord Chancellor?
Salt got up smiling and moved over to a cabinet against the wall.
There really is no one else. Everyone hates him, and he hates everyone, except me. Furthermore, he is a hard-nosed conservative who despises the merchant class and everything they stand for.
He opened the cabinet and took out 2 glasses and an ornate decanter.
If not exactly a friendly face on the council, he will at least be a sympathetic one, and damned hostile toward everyone else. I can hardly think of a more suitable candidate.
Glockter nodded.
He seems honest.
But not so honest that I'd trust him to put me in the bath. Would you, Your Eminence?
Yes, said Salt. He will be very valuable to us.
He poured out 2 glasses of rich red wine.
And just as a bonus, I was able to arrange for a sympathetic new master of the mints as well. I hear that the mercers are absolutely biting their tongues off with fury. Moravia's none too happy either, the bastard.
Salt chuckled to himself.
All good news, and we have you to thank.
He held out one of the glasses. Poison? A slow death, twitching and puking on the arch-lector's lovely mosaic floor? Or just pitching onto my face on his table? But there was really no option but to grasp the glass and take a hearty swig. The wine was unfamiliar but delicious. Probably from somewhere very beautiful and far away. At least if I die up here, I won't have to make it back down all those steps. But the arch-lector was drinking too, all smiles and good grace. So, I suppose I will last out the afternoon after all.
Yes, we have made a good first step. These are dangerous times, all right, and yet danger and opportunity often walk hand in hand.
Glockter felt a strange sensation creeping up his back. Is that fear, or ambition, or both?
I need someone to help me put matters in order. Someone who does not fear the superiors or the merchants, or even the closed council. Someone who can be relied upon to act with subtlety and discretion and ruthlessness. Someone whose loyalty to the Union is beyond question, but who has no friends within the government.
Someone who's hated by everyone? Someone to take the fall if things turn sour? Someone who will have few mourners at their funeral?
I have need of an inquisitor-exempt Glockter. Someone to operate beyond the superior's control, but with my full authority. Someone answerable only to me.
The arch-lector raised an eyebrow, as though the thought had only just come to him.
It strikes me that you are exceptionally well suited to this task. What do you think?
I think the holder of such a post would have a great many enemies and only one friend. Glockter peered up at the arch-lector. And that friend might not be so very reliable. I think the holder of such a post might not last long.
Could I have some time to consider it?
No.
Danger and opportunity often walk hand in hand.
Then I accept.
Excellent. I do believe this is the start of a long and productive relationship.
Salt smiled at him over the rim of his glass.
You know, Glockter, of all the merchants grubbing away out there, it is the mercers I find the most unpalatable. It was largely through their influence that Westport entered the Union, and it was because of Westport's money that we won the Gurkish War. The king rewarded them, of course, with priceless trading rights, but ever since then their arrogance has been insufferable. Anyone would have thought they fought the battles themselves for the airs they've put on and the liberties they've taken. The Honourable Guild of Mercers, he sneered. It occurs to me now that your friend Ruse has given us the means to hook them in so deeply, it would be a shame to let them wriggle free.
Glockter was much surprised, though he thought he hid it well. To go further? Why? The mercers wriggle free and they keep on paying, and that keeps all kinds of people happy. As things are, they're scared and soft, wondering who Ruse named, who might be next in the chair. If we go further, they may be hurt or finished entirely. Then they'll stop paying, and a lot of people will be unhappy. Some of them in this very building.
I can easily continue my investigations, Your Eminence, if you would like me to.
Glockter took another sip. It really was an excellent wine.
We must be cautious. Cautious and very thorough. The mercer's money flows like milk. They have many friends, even amongst the highest circles of the nobility. Brock, Huygen, Isher, and plenty more besides. Some of the very greatest men in the land. They've all been known to suck at that tit one time or another, and babies will cry when their milk is snatched away.
A cruel grin flickered across Salt's face.
But still, if children are to learn discipline, they must sometimes be made to weep. Who did that worm Ruse name in his confession?
Glockter leaned forward painfully and slid Ruse's paper of confession toward him, unfolded it, and scanned the list of names from bottom to top.
Sepp Dan Teufel, we all know.
Oh, we know and love him, Inquisitor, said Salt, beaming down. But I feel we may safely cross him off the list. Who else?
Well, let's see. Glockter took a leisurely look back at the paper. There's Harrod Polst, a mercer. A nobody.
Salt waved his hand impatiently.
He's nobody.
Solimo Scandi, a mercer from Westport. Also nobody.
No, Glockter, we can do better than Solimo... what's his name, can't we? These little mercers are of no real interest. Pull up the root, and the leaves die by themselves.
Quite so, Archlector. We have Willem Dan Rob, minor nobility, holds the junior customs post.
Salt looked thoughtful, shook his head.
Then there's...
Wait! Willem Dan Rob.
The Archlector snapped his fingers.
His brother Kiral is one of the Queen's gentlemen. He snubbed me at a social gathering.
Salt smiled.
Yes. Willem Dan Rob. Bring him in.
And so we go deeper. I serve and obey, Your Eminence. Is there anyone's name in particular that need be mentioned?
Glockter set down his empty glass.
No.
The Archlector turned away and waved his hand again.
Any of them, all of them. I don't care.
Chapter 9 First of the Magi. The lake stretched away, fringed by steep rocks and dripping greenery, surface pricked by the rain, flat and grey as far as the eye could see. Logan's eye couldn't see too far in this weather, it had to be said. The opposite shore could have been 100 strides away, but the calm waters looked deep, very deep. Logan had long ago given up any attempt at staying dry, and the water ran through his hair and down his face, dripped from his nose, his fingers, his chin. Being wet, tired, and hungry had become a part of life. It often had been, come to think of it. He closed his eyes and felt the rain patter against his skin, heard the water lapping on the shingle. He knelt by the lake, pulled the stopper from his flask and pushed it under the surface, watched the bubbles break as it filled up. Malachus Quai stumbled out of the bushes, breathing fast and shallow. He sank down to his knees, crawled against the roots of a tree, coughed out phlegm onto the pebbles. His coughing sounded bad now. It came right up from his guts and made his whole ribcage rattle. He was even paler than he had been when they first met, and a lot thinner. Logan was somewhat thinner, too. These were lean times, all in all. He walked over to the haggard apprentice and squatted down.
"Just give me a moment."
Quai closed his sunken eyes and tipped his head back.
"Just a moment."
His mouth hung open. The tendons in his scrawny neck standing out. He looked like a corpse already.
Don't rest too long. You might never get up.
Logan held out the flask. Quai didn't even lift his arm to take it, so Logan put it against his lips and tipped it up a little. He took a wincing swallow, coughed, then his head dropped back against the tree like a stone.
Do you know where we are? Asked Logan.
The apprentice blinked out at the water as though he'd only just noticed it.
This must be the north end of the lake. There should be a track.
His voice had sunk to a whisper.
At the southern end, there's a road with 2 stones.
He gave a sudden violent cough, swallowed with difficulty.
Follow the road over the bridge, and you're there, he croaked.
Logan looked off along the beach at the dripping trees.
How far is it?
No answer. He took hold of the sick man's bony shoulder and shook it. Quai's eyelids flickered open. He stared up blearily, trying to focus.
How far?
40 miles.
Logan sucked his teeth. Quai wouldn't be walking 40 miles. He'd be lucky to make 40 strides on his own. He knew it well enough. You could see it in his eyes. He'd be dead soon, Logan reckoned, a few days at the most.
He'd seen stronger men die of a fever. 40 miles. Logan thought about it carefully, rubbing his chin with his thumb. 40 miles.
Shit,
he whispered. He dragged the pack over and pulled it open. They had some food left, but not much. A few shreds of tough dried meat, a heel of moldy black bread. He looked out over the lake, so peaceful. They wouldn't be running out of drinking water any time soon, at least. He pulled his heavy cookpot out of his pack and set it down on the shingle. They'd been together a long time, but there was nothing left to cook. You can't become attached to things, not out here in the wild. He tossed the rope away into the bushes, then threw the lightened pack over his shoulder. Kwai's eyes had closed again, and he was scarcely breathing. Logan still remembered the first time he had to leave someone behind, remembered it like it was yesterday. Strange how the boy's name had gone, but the face was with him still. The shanker had taken a piece out of his thigh, a big piece. He'd moaned all the way, he couldn't walk. The wound was going bad, he was dying anyway. They had to leave him. No one had blamed Logan for it. The boy had been too young. He should never have gone. Bad luck was all, could happen to anyone. He'd cried after them as they made their way down the hillside in a grim, silent group, heads down. Logan seemed to hear the cries even when they'd left him far behind. He could still hear them. In the wars it had been different. Men dropped from the columns all the time on the long marches, in the cold months. First they fell to the back, then they fell behind. Then they fell over. The cold, the sick, the wounded. Logan shivered and hunched his shoulders. At first he'd tried to help them. Then he became grateful he wasn't one of them. Then he stepped over the corpses and hardly noticed them. You learn to tell when someone isn't getting up again. He looked at Malachus Kwai. One more death in the wild was nothing to remark upon. You have to be realistic, after all. The apprentice started from his fitful sleep and tried to push himself up. His hands were shaking bad. He looked up at Logan, eyes glittering bright.
I can't get up, he croaked.
I know. I'm surprised you made it this far. It didn't matter so much now. Logan knew the way. If he could find that track, he might make 20 miles a day.
If you leave me some of the food, perhaps, after you get to the library, someone...
No, said Logan, setting his jaw. I need the food. Kwai made a strange sound, somewhere between a cough and a sob. Logan leaned down and set his right shoulder in Kwai's stomach, pushed his arm under his back. I can't carry you 40 miles without it. And he straightened up, hauling the apprentice over his shoulder. He set off down the shore, holding Kwai in place by his jacket, his boots crunching into the wet shingle. The apprentice didn't even move, just hung there like a sack of wet rags, his limp arms knocking against the backs of Logan's legs. When he'd made it 30 strides or so, Logan turned around and looked back. The pot was sitting forlorn by the lake, already filling up with rainwater. They'd been through a lot together, him and that pot. Fare you well, old friend. The pot did not reply. Logan set his shivering burden gently down at the side of the road and stretched his aching back, scratched at the dirty bandage on his arm, took a drink of water from his flask. Water was the only thing to have passed his sore lips that day, and the hunger was gnawing at his guts. At least it had stopped raining. You have to learn to love the small things in life, like dry boots. You have to love the small things when you've nothing else. Logan spat in the dirt and rubbed the life back into his fingers. There was no missing the place, that was sure. The two stones towered over the road, ancient and pitted, patched with green moss at the base and grey lichen higher up.
They were covered in faded carvings, lines of letters in a script Logan couldn't understand, didn't even recognize. There was a forbidding feel about them, though, a sense more of warning than welcome.
"The First Law."
"What?" said Logan, surprised. Kwai had been in an unpleasant place between sleep and waking ever since they left the pot behind 2 days before. The pot could have made more meaningful sounds in that time. That morning, Logan had woken to find him scarcely breathing. He'd been sure that he was dead, to begin with, but the man was still clinging weakly to life. He didn't give up easy. He had to give him that. Logan knelt down and shoved the wet hair out of Kwai's face. The apprentice suddenly grabbed his wrist and started forward.
"It's forbidden,"
he whispered, staring at Logan with wide eyes.
"To touch the other side."
"Eh?"
"To speak with devils,"
he croaked, grabbing hold of Logan's battered coat.
"The creatures of the world below are made of lies. You mustn't do it."
"I won't," muttered Logan, wondering if he'd ever know what the apprentice was talking about. "I won't, for what that's worth." It wasn't worth much. Kwai had already dropped back into his twitching half-sleep. Logan chewed at his lip. He hoped the apprentice would wake again, but he didn't think it likely. Still, perhaps this Baez would be able to do something. He was the first of the Magi, after all, great in high wisdom and so on. So Logan hefted Kwai up onto his shoulder again and trudged between the ancient stones. The road climbed steep into the rocks above the lake, here built up, there cut deep into the stony ground. It was worn and pitted with age, pocked with weeds. It switched back on itself again and again, and soon Logan was panting and sweating, his legs burning with the effort. His pace began to slow. The fact was, he was getting tired. Not just tired from the climb or from the back-breaking slog he'd walked that day with a half-dead apprentice over his shoulder, or from the slog the day before, or even from the fight in the woods. He was tired of everything, of the shanker, of the wars, of his whole life.
"I can't walk forever, Malachus. I can't fight forever. How much of this horrible shit should a man have to take? I need to sit down a minute. In a proper fucking chair. Is that too much to ask? Is it?"
In this frame of mind, cursing and grumbling at every step, and with Kwai's head knocking against his arse, Logan came to the bridge. It was as ancient as the road, coated with creepers, simple and slender, arching maybe 20 strides across a dizzying gorge. Far below, a river surged over jagged rocks, filling the air with noise and shining spray. On the far side, a high wall had been built between towering faces of mossy stone, made with such care it was difficult to say where the natural cliff ended and the man-made one began. A single ancient door was set into it, faced with beaten copper, turned streaky green by the wet and the years. As Logan picked his way carefully across the slippery stone, he found himself wondering, through force of habit, how you could storm this place. You couldn't, not with 1,000 picked men. There was only a narrow shelf of rock before the door, no room to set a ladder or swing a ram. The wall was 10 strides high at least, and the gate had a dreadful solid look. And if the defenders were to bring down the bridge... Logan peered over the edge and swallowed. It was a long way down. He took a deep breath and thumped on the damp green copper with his fist. 4 big booming knocks. He'd beat on the gates of Carlion like that after the battle, and its people had rushed to surrender. No one rushed to do anything now. He waited. He knocked again. He waited. He became wetter and wetter in the mist from the river. He ground his teeth. He raised his arm to knock again. A narrow hatch snapped open, and a pair of roomy eyes stared at him coldly from between thick bars.
"Who's this now?"
snapped a gruff voice.
Logan Nine Fingers is my name. I've never heard of you.
Hardly the welcome Logan had been hoping for.
I've come to see Byers.
No reply.
The first of the...
Yes, he's here.
But the door didn't open.
He isn't taking visitors. I told that to the last messenger.
I'm no messenger. I have Malachus Quay with me.
Malacca what?
Quay, the apprentice.
Apprentice?
He's very ill, said Logan slowly. He may die.
Ill, you say? Die, was it?
Yes.
And what was your name again?
Just open the fucking door!
Logan shook his fist pointlessly at the slot.
Please.
We don't just let anyone in. Oh, look. Show me your hands.
What?
Your hands!
Logan held his hands up. The watery eyes moved slowly across his fingers.
There are nine. There's one missing, see?
He shoved the stump at the hatch.
Nine, is it? You should have said.
Bolts clanked and the door creaked slowly open. An elderly man, bent under an old-fashioned suit of armour, was staring at him suspiciously from the other side. He was holding a long sword much too heavy for him. Its point wobbled around wildly as he strained to keep it upright. Logan held up his hands.
I surrender.
The ancient gatekeeper was not amused. He grunted sourly as Logan stepped past him, then he wrestled the door shut and fumbled with the bolts, turned and trudged away without another word. Logan followed him up a narrow valley lined with strange houses, weathered and mossy, half dug into the steep rocks, merging with the mountainside. A dour-faced woman was working at a spinning wheel on a doorstep, and she frowned at Logan as he walked past with the unconscious apprentice over his shoulder. Logan smiled back at her. She was no beauty, that was sure, but it had been a very long time. The woman ducked into her house and kicked the door shut, leaving the wheel spinning. Logan sighed. The old magic was still there. The next house was a bakery with a squat smoking chimney. The smell of baking bread made Logan's empty stomach rumble. Further on, a couple of dark-haired children were laughing and playing, running round a scrubby old tree. They reminded Logan of his own children. They didn't look anything like them, but he was in a morbid frame of mind. He had to admit to being a little disappointed. He'd been expecting something cleverer looking, and a lot more beards. These folk didn't seem so very wise. They looked just like any other peasants, not unlike his own village had looked before the Shanker came. He wondered if he was in the right place. Then they rounded a bend in the road. Three great tapering towers were built into the mountainside ahead, joined at their bases but separating higher up, covered in dark ivy. They seemed far older even than the ancient bridge and road, as old as the mountain itself. A jumbled mess of other buildings crowded around their feet, straggling around the sides of a wide courtyard in which people were busy with everyday chores. A thin woman was churning some milk on a stoop. A stocky blacksmith was trying to shoe a restless mare. An old bald butcher in a stained apron had finished chopping up some animal and was washing his bloody forearms in a trough. And on a set of wide steps before the tallest of the three towers sat a magnificent old man. He was dressed all in white, with a long beard, a hook nose, and white hair spilling from under a white skullcap. Logan was impressed, finally. The first of the Magi surely looked the part. As Logan shuffled towards him, he started up from the steps and hurried over, white coat flapping behind him.
"Set him down here,"
he muttered, indicating a patch of grass by the well, and Logan knelt and dumped Quai on the ground, as gently as he could, with his back aching so much. The old man bent over him, laid a gnarled hand on his forehead.
"I brought your apprentice back," muttered Logan pointlessly.
"Mine? Aren't you Byers?"
The old man laughed.
Oh, no. I am Wells, his servant here at the library.
I am Bias, came a voice from behind.
The butcher was walking slowly toward them, wiping his hands on a cloth. He looked maybe 60, but heavily built, with a strong face, deeply lined, and a close-cropped grey beard around his mouth. He was entirely bald, and the afternoon sun shone brightly off his tanned pate. He was neither handsome nor majestic, but as he came closer, there did seem to be something about him. An assurance, an air of command, a man used to giving orders and to being obeyed. The first of the magi took Logan's left hand in both of his and pressed it warmly. Then he turned it over and examined the stump of his missing finger.
Logan Ninefingers, then, the one they call the Bloody Nine. I have heard stories about you, even shut up here in my library.
Logan winced. He could guess what sort of stories the old man might have heard.
That was a long time ago. Of course, we all have a past, eh? I make no judgments on hearsay.
And Byers smiled, a broad, white, beaming smile. His face lit up with friendly creases, but a hardness lingered around his eyes, deep-set and glistening green. A stony hardness. Logan grinned back, but he reckoned already that he wouldn't want to make an enemy of this man.
And you have brought our missing lamb back to the fold.
Byers frowned down at Malachus Quai, motionless on the grass.
How is he?
I think he will live, sir, said Wells, but we should get him out of the cold.
The first of the magi snapped his fingers, and a sharp crack echoed from the buildings.
Help him!
The smith hurried forward and took Quai's feet, and together he and Wells carried the apprentice through the tall door into the library.
Now, Master Ninefingers, I have called and you have answered, and that shows good manners. Manners might be out of fashion in the north, but I want you to know that I appreciate them. Courtesy should be answered with courtesy, I have always thought. But what's this now?
The old gatekeeper was hurrying back across the yard, greatly out of breath.
Two visitors in one day? Whatever next?
Master Byers,
wheezed the gatekeeper.
This rider's at the gate, well-horsed and well-armed. They say they've an urgent message from the King of the Northmen.
Beth thought. It had to be. The spirits had said he had given himself a golden hat, and who else would have dared to call himself King of the Northmen? Logan swallowed. He'd got away from their last meeting with his life and nothing else, and yet it was better than many had managed, far better.
"Well, master," asked the gatekeeper, "shall I tell them to be off?"
"Who leads them?"
"A fancy lad with a sour face. Said he's this king's son or something."
"Was it Calder or Scale? They're both something sour."
"The younger one, I reckon."
Calder, then. That was something. Either one was bad, but Scale was much the worse. Both together were an experience to be avoided. Byers seemed to consider a moment.
"Prince Calder may enter, but his men must remain beyond the bridge."
"Yes, sir. Beyond the bridge."
The gatekeeper wheezed away. He'd love that, would Calder. Logan was greatly tickled by the thought of the so-called prince screaming uselessly through that little slot.
"The King of the Northmen, now, can you imagine?"
Byers stared absently off down the valley.
"I knew Bethord when he was not so grand. And so did you, hey, Master Ninefingers?"
Logan frowned. He'd known Bethord when he was next to nothing, a little chieftain like so many others. Logan had come for help against the Shankar, and Bethord had given it, at a price. Back then, the price had seemed light and well worth the paying, just to fight, to kill a few men. Logan had always found killing easy, and Bethard had seemed a man well worth fighting for, bold, proud, ruthless, venomously ambitious. All qualities that Logan had admired back then. All qualities he thought he had himself. But time had changed them both, and the price had risen. "He used to be a better man," Baez was musing, "but crowns sit badly on some people. Do you know his sons?"
"Better than I'd like."
Baez nodded. "They're absolute shit, aren't they? And I fear now they will never improve. Imagine that pinhead scale a king." The wizard shuddered. "It almost makes you want to wish his father a long life."
"Almost, but not quite."
The little girl that Logan had seen playing scurried over. She had a chain of yellow flowers in her hands, and she held it up to the old wizard.
"I made this," she said.
Logan could hear the rapid pounding of hooves coming up the road.
"For me? How perfectly charming."
Baez took the flowers from her.
"Excellent work, my dear. The master maker himself could not have done better."
The rider clattered out into the yard, pulled his horse up savagely, and swung from the saddle. Calder. The years had been kinder to him than to Logan, that much was clear. He was dressed all in fine blacks trimmed with dark fur. A big red jewel flashed on his finger, the hilt of his sword was set with gold. He'd grown and filled out, half the size of his brother Scale, but a big man still. His pale, proud face was pretty much as Logan remembered, though, thin lips twisted in a permanent sneer. He threw his reins at the woman churning milk, then strode briskly across the yard, glowering about him, his long hair flapping in the breeze. When he was about 10 strides away, he saw Logan. His jaw dropped. Calder took a shocked half-step back, and his hand twitched towards his sword. Then he smiled a cold little smile.
"So, you've taken to keeping dogs, have you, Bias? I'd watch this one. He's been known to bite his master's hand."
His lip curled further.
"I could put him down for you if you'd like."
Logan shrugged. Hard words are for fools and cowards. Calder might have been both, but Logan was neither. If you mean to kill, you're better getting right to it than talking about it. Talk only makes the other man ready, and that's the last thing you want. So Logan said nothing. Calder could take that for weakness if he pleased, and so much the better. Fights might find Logan depressingly often, but he was long, long past looking for them. Bethard's second son turned his contempt on the first of the Magi.
"My father will be displeased, Baez. That my men must wait outside the gate shows little respect."
"But I have so little, Prince Calder," said the wizard calmly. "Please don't be downhearted, though. Your last messenger wasn't allowed over the bridge, so you see we're making progress."
Calder scowled.
"Why have you not answered my father's summons?"
"There are so many demands on my time."
Baez held up the chain of flowers.
"These don't make themselves, you know."
The prince was not amused.
"My father," he boomed, "Bethard, King of the Northmen, commands you to attend upon him at Carleon."
He cleared his throat.
"He will not,"
he coughed.
"What?"
demanded Baez.
"Speak up, child." "He commands?"
The prince coughed again, spluttered, choked. He put a hand to his throat. The air seemed to have become very still.
"Commands, does he?"
Baez frowned.
"Bring great Juvens back from the land of the dead. He may command me. He alone and no other."
The frown grew deeper still, and Logan had to resist a strange desire to back away.
"You may not, nor may your father, whatever he calls himself."
Calder sank slowly to his knees, face twisted, eyes watering. Baez looked him up and down.
"What solemn attire! Did somebody die?"
Here. And he tossed the chain of flowers over the prince's head. A little colour may lighten your mood. Tell your father he must come himself. I do not waste my time on fools and younger sons. I am old.